The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
If you create a fictional dam around your fiction, right? If you surround it by every side, by more fiction, it enhances the effect of reality of the isolated or framed narrative. So it's like it's almost as if you had an isthmus, you know, connected to referential reality, you know, a peninsula, and then you sever that isthmus and you turn it into an island surrounded only by fiction.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. This is your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Award-winning author and Pulitzer Prize finalist, Hernan Diaz, spoke to me about rejection, his unusual path to literary stardom, subverting reader expectations, and his latest novel, Trust. Hernan is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and Penn Faulkner Award. His first novel, In the Distance, won the Saroyan International Prize, the Cabell Award, the Prix Page America, and the New American Voices Award, among other distinctions. His latest novel, Trust, has been named one of 2022's most anticipated books by the New York Times, Oprah Daily, The Today Show, Vogue, Vulture, AV Club, and many more. Described as an immersive story and a brilliant literary puzzle about money, power, intimacy, and perception, The New York Times called Trust intricate, cunning, and consistently surprising. Hernan holds a PhD from NYU. It's an academic journal at Columbia University. And his stories and essays have appeared in The Paris Review, Granta, Playboy, The Yale Review, McSweeney's, and elsewhere. In this file, Hernan and I discussed why the path to publication is a catch-22 for authors, the lonely road to Pulitzer nominee, and the disorientation of fame. What he learned from Jorge Luis Borges, remapping the isthmus of referential reality, how he unlearned academic writing, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are back on The Writer Files. I am truly honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. I have award-winning author Hernan Diaz is joining us, and I hope I pronounced that properly.
You did wonderfully, Kelton. Thank you for having me.
That means you messed it up.
No. Trust me.
Okay. Well, I know that you've been doing a lot of interviews and you've been doing the circuit for the latest Trust, which is quite a miraculous book. But yeah, I can't wait to talk about that and all of the amazing praise and these fantastic reviews that you've garnered. But let's talk about your amazing journey, this superhero origin story from, you know, go take us back a little bit, the early days before the Pulitzer nomination and yeah, talk a little bit about your journey as an author and how you came to this place now.
Well, I'm the son of booksellers. That my parents had a bookshop when I was born. Then, you know, they also had other jobs later on, but at that particular time they owned a bookshop. And I grew up around books. And ever since I can remember, I wanted to be involved with books in some way or another. I wrote stories as a kid, you know, terrible, terrible stuff. I wrote even more terrible poems. I drew comic books. Like, storytelling was my thing. And I read voraciously, always. And, I went into the humanities, into academia, because I thought that was the best way of being closer to the literary world. And it turns out that that's not necessarily true. But, you know, I was heavily invested in academia. I did my PhD. I was a tenure track professor and all of that. And I kept writing throughout all of it. And then at a certain point, I realized that I had steered too far away from literature itself and become too concerned with, criticism and theory and philosophy and things that are adjacent to literature, but not literature itself. Mm-hmm. And I doubled down on writing stories and a whole novel that was finished. And all my stories and that novel were universally rejected. Mm-hmm. I've lost count, and I I got very depressed. You know, it's scary, and I hope, you know, if young writers are tuning in, it's a very real thing, you know, to experience rejection on that scale and still keep at it. It feels like you're a little crazy because you feel you want to do this and you're convinced about this calling, if you want to call it that way. And yet the world is telling you that it's worthless in some way, you know, or doesn't want to hear about it. But the only way forward is just to keep going, which starts feeling a bit insane at some point, you know, like, so I started writing my second novel, which was In the Distance. I gave up on trying to get the first one published and started a whole new project. And I sent it to Coffee House Press, which was, it is an independent press, exquisite and independent press out of Minneapolis. Because, of course, the catch-22 is that, you know, no publisher will touch your work unless you have an agent, and no agent will take you on unless you have published work. So it's, you know, so I sent it to the slush pile, and it got, you know, someone read it with care and love, and it got published.
Amazing. And the rest is history, as I say. And you've just been kicking back since then, right?
Yeah, just chilling, taking it easy. That's who I am. No, it's just as I said at the beginning, this is what I want to be doing all of the time, and reading and writing. It's not a chore. It's not that I would rather be doing something else. It's rather the opposite. It's like everything else seems like an obstacle that keeps me away from that. So if, you know, what has come with the recognition that the first book got to some extent and has been, you know, the privilege of being to devote more and more time to this. That's the main thing. And the other thing is that I also got to meet a number of writers that, you know, sort of heroes, people I admired, and now, you know, I get to like talk to them, and you know, that's amazing how I was very lonely before all of this, and now I have more friends, which is nice.
amazing. Yeah. Yeah, so after all the prizes and, of course, the recognition, there must have been a time when your head was kind of spinning, like, is this real? Like, is this really happening to me? Did you ever have a moment of, like, you know, we talked to a lot of authors, big-name authors, about this moment of kind of, you know, like an imposter syndrome, like, am I really supposed to be here?
I don't know. I mean, it was disorienting more than anything else. It was very, like couldn't find my bearings, because as I was just telling you, it had been a world of rejection. It had been a very lonely, journey in, you know, not in a heroic kind of, you know, way, but in a really sad, depressing way. So all of a sudden, you know, there is a lot of beautiful noise, you know, but it's very loud around you. And there's a lot of people, a lot of whom also are very lovely, but it's a big shift. And so it was, if anything, it was disorienting, and I had to sort of learn how to deal with that. And of course, the response, as always, was in books. It's just turning back to literature and turning back to reading novels that I love, rediscovering new books and trying to write a new book, and, you know, and going back to that, and, you know, going back at failing again and failing better and just keeping at it.
I like that. Well, of course, your colleagues have come out of the woodwork to praise your latest, Emma Straub, who is actually going to be on this show later this month.
She's delightful. I love Emma. She's great. Yes.
She called the book absolutely magnificent. Truth, of course, a
Matryoshka doll. Yeah.
Oh, Matryoshka doll.
It's the nesting Russian dolls.
Right. Yes. The Matryoshka doll of a novel, an onion of a novel. Each layer exposes a more urgent truth. And this nice blurb from Rachel Kushner, very classical and very original. Balzac would be proud. But so would Borges. And talk a little bit about the influence of Borges, actually. And as we just had mentioned, the kind of the nesting worlds effect of your latest. And then we'll talk about Truth just kind of as a, you know, where the premise came from and how you of undertook it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was telling you a moment ago that, I have this whole background in academia, you know, I still edit an academic journal, which is very sort of esoteric and in full on academies. I wrote a whole book about Borges. He's a massive influence in my life, even beyond literature. And I think one of the things that I learned from Borges that is germane to this conversation and pertinent to Trust is sort of the way in which he plays with tradition. He has a very playful approach and irreverent approach to tradition and mashing up different strands and different authors and different canons. I find that very productive in my own work. I also do that a lot. Another thing that I do is I love to play with genres, which Borges, of course, was a master of. You read these short stories that are, in fact, philosophical treatises, and or you read a piece of what you think is philosophy, and then it turns out to be a piece of fiction, you know. So subverting the expectations of the reader is something that he's very good at in terms of genre. And then lastly, frames, of course. I actually have a whole chapter in my book on Borges about how he uses the framing structure, which is, you know, a very old device in the history of literature. But the remarkable thing is that literature changes, it mutates over time. But this is, and a lot of devices, you know, fall out of fashion. But we keep telling framed narratives, you know, these nesting narratives. And I think we do that because if you create a fictional dam around your fiction, right? If you surround it by every side by more fiction, it enhances the effect of reality of the isolated or framed narrative. So it's like it's almost as if you had an isthmus, you know, connected to referential reality, you know, a peninsula, and then you sever that isthmus and you turn it into an island surrounded only by fiction. And I don't know. I love that, and I find myself. I did it in The Distance is a frame narrative, and this is this takes it a step further because it's many different documents and texts interacting in all kinds of weird ways.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Because it is four kind of interlocking pieces in a sense, talk about the spark of, you know, when kind of when you realized that trust was going to interweave these four narratives. Of course, they're all told from not only different points of view, but in different genres, right?
That's right. Different points of view, different genres, different time periods. They're radically different, and stylistically they couldn't be more disparate. You know, the thing is, there are many answers to this question as to why this is the structure that I chose. There isn't one single answer. I can give you a few of them. One is that, and this is sort of a truism or sort of a little bit obvious, but if you're concerned with truth and the representation of truth, you have to acknowledge that truth is by nature prismatic. It can't be accessed from one single point of view, unless we're talking about mathematical truth, right? But otherwise, you know, among human beings and their interactions, it's necessarily a composite, right? So. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why this had to be told in this way. An additional reason is that one of the central concerns of the book is capital, money, wealth. And in the American myth of wealth, it's always one man, and I use the word man very, very deliberately, it's one man pulling himself up by his bootstraps and through his ingenuity, sort of amassing this fortune with the will of a sort of a financial pioneer, you know, doing it, the self-made man. And the truth is, however, that wealth is polyphonic, like a multitude goes into a fortune, mainly the multitude of, you know, the labor that goes into a fortune. And if you create a myth of the single strong-willed man who made this happen, that means you're silencing all the voices, you know, on which this man actually stands. Mm-hmm. And among those voices are the voices of women who are, and this is something I discovered in my archival work toward this novel, there are no women in the history of wealth in America, neither in fiction nor in history. And I wanted to subvert this, and so my main characters and my main narrators are women here, and how their voices have been suppressed, and so that's a central concern and an additional reason, or perhaps the most important reason, why this book is so polyphonic, why it has so many voices.
Amazing, yeah. I mean, I think a part of it, to me at least, is that, you know, I wonder if your background in philosophy and your studies in philosophy can't help but kind of bleed into the work. Does that define at times that you're accessing?
Yeah, I think, I think a couple of things come from having dealt with that kind of body of texts, you know, more theoretical books and such. The first one is not being afraid of a certain type of velocity in prose, which is, you know, I like sometimes in my books for things to really slow down, you know, in terms of the reading experience. And this is something I've learned from reading a lot of philosophy and theory. Like it takes more time, you know, to read a philosophical text than it does to read some fiction. Other fiction is equally dense. But So, you know, it doesn't mean that my prose is dense. I honestly don't think it is. But it does mean that I'm interested in that kind of register too. You know, not exclusively, but at certain points in my work and in my novels, I like for things to slow down, and that's something I've learned from reading that kind of texts. I would also add sort of a certain, you know, patience in terms of the archival work and just sticking with it and going to the library every day and, you know, looking through catalogs and just reading materials that seem irrelevant at first, but then there is that nugget there that makes it all worth it. And that, you know, that's a lot of hours there. And I think that comes from my academic training too, but I don't want my books to sound academic in any way at all. And I don't think I can say with confidence they do not. And that was also a hard process for me to unlearn academic writing and, you know, just completely do away with it in my fiction, which I have. Like, I don't want it to contaminate it in any shape or form.
Of course, I want to talk about the research process, and you're talking about looking at archival stuff. So to capture like the 20s and 30s, is that kind of the piece you're talking about? So are you going back and looking at historical documents and looking at, again, as you said, different, you know, what, magazines and newspapers and whatnot?
Yes, all of the above and beyond, I would say. The book starts sort of in the 1880s-ish. And ends in the 1980s. So it spans effectively a whole century. And weirdly enough, like, the 80s are far away enough to require a little bit of digging too. It feels strange for this middle-aged person to say this, but it's true. And So, also because I come from the humanities, I don't know a lot about money and that whole thing, you know, the rhetoric of money. So that was a steep learning curve, and I had to study a lot and learn how to talk about money. That is one side. Another interesting side is that I looked at the personal papers of some of the wives of real American tycoons, you know, and went to these archives, requested their personal papers, and looked at them, which was very inspiring and in some cases rather heartbreaking to see, you know, the tedious marginal roles into which they had been pushed, you know, and also sort of the lack of interest that their remaining papers have, you know, nobody has requested them or looked at them since they were archived in some cases. Like, for 100 years, nobody has bothered to look at what these lives were all about. So that was a very interesting side of the research process as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So when you are really getting into a flow state, and once you have kind of passed through the majority of the research piece, talk about your ideal writing day. Talk about a day, you know, how does that day start? Does it start with coffee? Are you a morning writer? Are you a nighttime writer? How are you getting into a flow state?
I used to be like a vampire, even more than a night writer. I lived sort of in a reverse kind of inverted world where I would write all night and kind of sleep most of the day. But then, you know, I also became a parent, so that didn't work at all with having a kid. But I have become a morning writer, and when I'm deep into writing, I like to get up very, very early, like between 4 and 5, and because, you know, nobody's sending me emails at that time, and nobody's calling. The New York Times page is not being updated, you know, there's nothing. So, you know, even if you want to procrastinate, you know, you really can't, or not to such a large extent. I write by hand in notebooks, and then I usually start my day my writing day by transcribing, typing the passages that I have written the previous day in longhand. And that gets me into the headspace. And then after transcribing that, you know, I'm in the world, and then I go back to my notepad and my notebook and my pen and keep writing longhand. So that's more or less the process.
That's cool. Yeah, so you're using, it would seem, different parts of your brain when you are writing by hand, because there is something to be said about that piece. And then, of course, transcribing it, as you said, it's getting you into the world, and then you're continuing that by going back to handwriting, which I find fascinating.
Yeah. But also, it's, you know, I don't work with drafts. Like, I hear my writer friends saying, oh, I'm on my third draft, and which is totally cool. I mean, I don't think they're recipes at all. It doesn't matter. Whatever works for you is the way to go. Yeah. It's just, I've never wrote that way. I edit a lot as I go. Like, most of my writing day consists of editing what I have, and then I add a couple of hundred words a day to that, which means that by the time I get to the end, I have pretty much a finished manuscript.
Yeah, interesting. I can't remember who said it, but they were talking about this writer who says, "I go very slowly, but I get it right the first time."
Ooh, yeah.
So, well, that sounds
lucky
like
him. If it was a man, but no, yeah,
no, it was a woman. It was a woman.
Oh, okay.
In her defense.
Lucky her. Well, I go slowly, but I get it wrong the first time.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's humility speaking there. That's very nice. Congrats on this incredibly well received
thank you, sir.
Latest. And I mean, you must be pretty pleased with how things have gone here. I mean the page of blurbs and reviews and I mean, it goes on for, like, we could spend two shows reading these comments, but congrats.
Thank you.
It's really
thank
cool
you,
to
thank
see.
Thank you so much.
I must feel good, like a little sigh of relief there, sending your second book out of the world.
Yes, indeed.
But I will just mention, Tress, of course, we'll link to the book, At Once an Immersive Story and a Brilliant Literary Puzzle. Trust engages the reader in a quest for the truth while confronting the deceptions that often live at the heart of personal relationships, the reality warping force of capital, and the ease with which power can manipulate facts. Well, you know, I mean, I thought your short interview with Scott Simon on NPR was very enlightening. I'll link to that as well. But he had just described the book as spun from four narratives, a novel wrought from the tale of the life of Andrew Bevel, a financial baron during the 1929 stock market crash, then his attempt to write his own story, then his secretary's memoir, and finally the journal left by his deceased wife, Mildred. So he kind of sums up how the book is structured, and brilliantly wrought, of course. But I had a couple more questions for you before we wrap with kind of your just final advice to fellow scribes. Are you a coffee or tea drinker?
Coffee in the morning. Yeah. No, coffee in the morning. If I'm too tired, maybe tea. I allow myself in the afternoon because I'm, okay. You know, I'm an insomniac, so I can't do coffee in the afternoon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That is wise. Yeah. What's your favorite cocktail?
Martini, obviously. Okay. Gin. I mean, that shouldn't be a clarification that should ever be made.
You had mentioned this handwriting in notebooks and your kind of the way that you're structuring these books, but talk about this pen that you've had. I saw you talking about this with on late night television with Seth Meyers, talking about your pen and how you've had the same fountain pen for 20 years. Yes. Is this really a thing? That's amazing.
I'm holding it as I speak with you. And this pen has actually stolen the whole show. Everybody wants to know about
Everyone
the pen.
Everyone wants to know now.
Yeah. Yeah. The pen, it's actually, I realized after leaving the show, is older than 20 years. I'm glad I said just 20 years because it doesn't okay. make me look that old. So, but it has a few more years on it. And right. it was given to me by a dear friend and mentor all those years ago, over two decades.
Amazing.
And I've everything that I've written with this pen. It's a fountain pen. I change the ink color every now and then. But I've settled on one that's called Midnight Blue, which is a tacky name, but it's a great color. And yeah, it's, you know, it travels with me everywhere. And it's an object that it's so just has so much aura for me now because, you know, we've been through so much together, but amazing. I'm terrified of losing it. But it does come with me wherever I go.
Yeah. Do you think it confers upon the well, we won't talk about that. We don't want to jinx it.
I'm not superstitious, but okay.
Good. Yeah. Let's see. A fun one for you. If you could have dinner with any author from any era, to your favorite spot in the world, who would you take and where would you take them?
Oh, that's easy. I would have dinner with George Eliot. She is probably one of my favorite, she is one of my favorite novelists. Hmm. And she knew everything about literature, everything about philosophy. She translated Spinoza, you know, into English from Latin, hung out with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Wagner. I don't know. She was fascinating. Yeah. And I would probably take her to my favorite restaurant, which is here in Brooklyn, and it's called the Four Horsemen. And we would have, you know, several courses and hopefully get a little buzzed after a bottle or two of wine.
Yeah. Getting buzzed with George Eliot.
Yeah, that's all. Oh, can you imagine? Man.
That sounds fun. Sounds like a lot of fun. All right. Let's just wrap with your final pearl of wisdom, just to fellow scribes on how to persevere, how to keep going, because you kind of started us off with some great wisdom on the craft.
How to keep going? It's a tough question. I think how to keep going is a question that never goes away. Like I just finished this book, and I'm asking myself how to keep going. And I think part of it is to keep that question alive. I think that once you've settled on an answer, a lot of avenues just collapse and die immediately. Avenues that you want to keep open, right? Hmm. So part of keeping a rich writerly life is to ask yourself constantly how to keep going. And to lead and to live and to with that anxiety that creates, and to try to look for new solutions each time. Like I think once you come up with a formula, you should be a little cautious and question it. That would be my piece of advice.
Wow, fantastic, Hernan! Thank you so much for taking the time to do this today.
Oh, Kelton, thank you.
We really appreciate your time, your wisdom. Please come back and really best of luck with the rest of your book tour and congrats. It is well deserved.
So grateful. Thank you for having me. Would love to be back whenever you want to have me again. And best of luck to you too.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.